I'm Gail Harris.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
Ahmed Chalabi, the Iraqi politician and former Bush administration ally, is being accused by U.S. officials of telling an Iranian that the U.S. had succeeded in breaking the secret communications code of the Iranian intelligence service. The New York Times reports an intercepted Iranian cable which suggests that Chalabi obtained his information from a drunken American official. U.S. and Iraqi security forces raided Mr. Chalabi's Baghdad headquarters and cut off aid to his Iraqi National Congress last month, apparently because of Chalabi's alleged relationship with Iran. We're joined now by Intifad Khanbar, spokesperson for Ahmed Chalabi. Welcome, Mr. Khanbar.
Thank you.
And your response to the allegation that Ahmed Chalabi told Iranians that the U.S. had cracked Iran's secret intelligence code.
This is not true. These allegations are false. This is a smear campaign by the CIA. Ahmed Chalabi has no access to any classified information in the U.S., and Ahmed Chalabi did not pass anything that threatens the United States national security to any country in the world. These allegations are unattributed, unsubstantiated, and Ahmed Chalabi is ready to come and testify under oath to defeat these allegations.
Well, as you know, American officials have said that there was a cable sent by an Iranian to Tehran detailing a conversation that he had with Mr. Chalabi, telling him about this break in the code. Will you demand that U.S. officials produce that cable?
We want the United States Congress to investigate this matter, and we're ready to testify under oath, and we know that we are going to be able to clear out these allegations. Why the Iranians sent a message with a code that they knew it's broken, we don't know why. It could be disinformation by the Iranians. I wonder why would the CIA believe the enemies of the United States, such as Iran, and disbelieve the friend of the United States, such as Ahmed Chalabi.
Did Mr. Chalabi have contacts with Iranian intelligence agencies?
Ahmed Chalabi had open relations with Iran. Iran has the longest border with Iraq. The United States of America is trying to open channels and communications with Iran. And the relation with Iran is a relation between two neighboring countries. And Dr. Chalabi, as an Iraqi politician, has to be part of this relation.
Well, it's one thing to have relations with a country, but according to reports in the Guardian newspaper, Mr. Chalabi told Scott Ritter, the U.S. weapons inspector, that he had close ties with Iranian intelligence. Does he have close ties with Iranian intelligence?
Well, there is coordination at all levels with the Iranians for the benefit of both countries.
So you're saying that he may have spoken to Iranian intelligence officers, but he did not pass information about the U.S.?
I am confident that he did not pass any information to the U.S. Since we don't have any access to any classified information in the U.S., there is nothing to pass, nor this is the type of practice that Chalabi would do. Mm-hmm. And again, I think it is better for Congress to investigate this matter, and we're ready to stand it.
Why do you think this is happening? Why do you think Mr. Chalabi is being investigated like this?
Because we have long problems with the CIA. The CIA wanted to remove Saddam by a coup. We wanted to remove Saddam by a liberation process to remove the whole system.
And Mr. Khanbar, why do you think your former allies in the Pentagon have abandoned you?
They have not abandoned us. The same friends we had before are our friends today, and we are still friends with the United States of America.
Intifad Khanbar, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Intifad Khanbar, a spokesperson for Ahmed Chalabi and the Iraqi National Congress. He spoke to us from Washington, D.C.
With the transfer of power from coalition forces to the new interim Iraqi government less than a month away now, President Bush has been busy promoting the spread of democracy in the Middle East. His public comments, notably yesterday's press conference and today's speech before the Air Force Academy in Colorado, are emphasizing, in Bush's words, there is a need for us to understand that democracy can take hold in the Middle East. But can the American model succeed in Iraq and beyond? Rami Khoury is editor of the Daily Star newspaper in Beirut, Lebanon. And Rami, President Bush said at his news conference yesterday that creating a democracy in the Middle East would be a game changer. What do those words mean to you, and do you think it would be a game changer?
Well, first of all, it probably would not be a game changer. It may have some impact on certain people in certain societies, but I don't think it would be a game changer. First of all, this isn't a game, and second of all, things are not changed by foreign armies in this region. The reaction I think that most people have and that I have is, first of all, the values that define democracy as it is practiced in the U.S. or in Europe or in other places are values that are deeply embedded in most of the cultures and religions and ethics of this region, whether it's accountability or pluralism or coexistence or tolerance or justice or rule of law. These are ancient values, most of which actually came out of this region around 3,000 years ago. The point is that you have to separate the Middle East region's quest for democracy, which is very real, from the question of can democracy be delivered through the craftsmanship of White House speechwriters. And the answer to both of those is no, it cannot.
Well, is there some other form of representative government that might work better?
Oh, no, there's nothing wrong with the form of democracy as it is practiced in the U.S. or democracy as it is globally practiced. Of course, there's many different forms. If you look at Japan and Italy and the U.S., they have very different kinds of democracies. I mean, you're talking basically in the end of the consent of the governed, the rule of law, some kind of participation, some kind of formal accountability, and respect for human rights and pluralism and diversity. The real problem that we have in the Middle East with the American focus on trying to promote democracy now, that the United States didn't need to do all this to promote democracy. It could promote democracy tomorrow, right now, next 3 hours, in countries where it has enormous influence already, in places like Egypt, Morocco, Saudi Arabia, Jordan, Yemen, other places where the U.S. is basically guaranteeing the survival or at least the well-being of many of these countries. It doesn't have to send 150,000 troops and make a war and end up with 900 American dead and tens of thousands of Iraqis dead and terrorism spreading throughout the region and Americans being shot in Saudi Arabia as they were today. And when the American president gives that as the rationale, we don't believe it.
I want to ask you about the UN envoy, Lakhdar Brahimi's comment that Paul Bremer is essentially the dictator of Iraq right now, that nothing much gets done without his approval. I wonder how the Arab world is seeing this new interim government.
I think there's a combination of hope, relief, and skepticism. I mean, there's hope that it will pave the way towards a real full transition to Iraqi sovereignty and independence and the American-British-led occupation. There is fear that the government, this interim government, will prove to be not very legitimate, to be seen to be a stepchild of the American-led occupation. But there's also desire to see this work.
President Bush seems fairly convinced that creating a more democratic Iraq would help address some of the root causes of terrorism.
We need to get better government systems and the rule of law and democracy for sure. But my sense is that terror has become a much bigger problem now all around the world because of what the U.S. did in Iraq, at least in the short run. Maybe a year or two from now, things will be different. But you've got bombs exploding in Madrid and Australia and Bali and Saudi Arabia. Americans are being killed. So the war on terror has actually promoted and decentralized the whole terror system around the world. And I think the United States really should rethink this very carefully.
Rami Khoury, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Rami Khoury is editor of the Daily Star newspaper in Beirut, Lebanon.
A potentially embarrassing memo from the White House has become public. It warns federal agencies to expect big budget cuts in a second Bush term. Officials at the Office of Management and Budget say the memo is a routine document, part of crafting the nation's budget. But the president is currently touting programs on the campaign trail, Head Start, Homeland Security, food programs for poor families, that are among those threatened with cuts in the memo. Joining us on the line is Liam Panetta. He served as director of the Office of Management and Budget in the first Clinton administration and chief of staff in the second. He now heads the Panetta Institute in Monterey Bay, California. Welcome, Leon.
Nice to be with you, Robin.
Well, you have played a couple of roles here. Let's first talk about the process, which you're familiar with. You held the same job as the current head of the OMB, Joshua Bolton. Is this memo the final word on what a post-election Bush budget will look like, or is it, as some have said, just process?
Well, it is part of the budget process. The Office of Management and Budget usually provides what's called budget guidance to all of the agencies and departments to help them shape their budget for the future. the agencies can or cannot abide by that guidance. They can, in the end, appeal the decision not just to the Office of Management and Budget, but directly to the president. So I think it's fair to say that in the end, the president will fully decide what programs will be included in the final budget. And that process will probably go on between now through November or December of this year.
Well, and then there are the politics of this, because the administration is, as we know, campaigning. It's a presidential election year. And they're touting a $1.7 billion increase in discretionary funding for education. But the guideline that we mentioned, the memo, says there's actually going to be a huge cutback. So what are you seeing here? And is this something that the Clinton administration had to do as well, campaign on the hope, while knowing that, in fact, there may be the cut?
Well, there's a lot to that. I mean, obviously, the president's on a campaign trail, and he's not going to convey the impression that he's going to cut the very programs that he's touting as he's going through the campaign. So clearly, from a political point of view, you're not going to hear the president mention any of those programs that were contained in the OMB memo that was sent out. But at the same time, if he's reelected, even if he's not reelected, he still has to come up with a budget. And the real question there is what choices is he going to make? I mean, you know, there are really three approaches here. One is he can continue to borrow and spend, which is the easiest approach of all. That's what he's been doing the last 4 years. Basically, the bar's been open and everybody's been drinking, he plus the Congress, and spending has gone up dramatically. The second one is the kind of don't blame me approach, which is he can make proposals, but they're unrealistic and Congress rejects them. Or he can do what I think is right, which is to make the tough choices, which include both taxes and spending cuts. That's what Reagan had to do. That's what his father had to do. That's what Bill Clinton had to do. And I think ultimately the real question is whether he's going to be willing to make those kinds of tough choices.
Mm. By the way, you're a Democrat. Are you advising the John Kerry campaign?
I've given guidance to the campaign, particularly with regards to this issue, which I feel strongly about. After all, this is a president who hasn't vetoed one appropriations bill in the Congress. I mean, he has not vetoed one spending bill in the Congress. That's unheard of.
Cynics might say, Leon Panetta, that you might have done the same thing when you were preparing your budget for President Clinton. Did you ever approach President Bill Clinton and say, you can't do this, my numbers show that, you know, we just can't say that, we're going to have to cut that?
Well, there were times when the president would want to introduce a new program, and very frankly, the Office of Management and Budget and other advisors basically said, you know, if you're going to do that, you have to show a way to pay for it, and he would be willing to sit down and do that. One of the good things about President Clinton was he was willing to decide that there are certain priorities he could fund, but there were an awful lot of programs that had to be cut, and he always touted his priorities, which usually got funded, and never talked about the programs that had to be cut. And I think that's the smart way to campaign.
Leon Panetta, thank you.
Thank you.
Leon Panetta, director of the Panetta Institute and a director of the White House Office of Management and Budget in the Clinton administration. He joined us from Monterey Bay, California.
Just ahead, are candidates Bush and Kerry paying enough attention to Latino voters?
And later, Bill Cosby's admonition of African Americans.
There's more coming up here and now.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Gail Harris.
It's Here and Now.
Every 10 years, the census reveals something new about the United States. What jumped out in 2000 was the huge increase in the Hispanic population. That number rose almost 60% in the years between 1990 and 2000. So, not surprisingly, political strategists are paying attention as they focus on crucial voting blocks this election year. TV journalist Jorge Ramos writes about this trend in his new book, The Latino Wave, How Hispanics Will Elect the Next American President. Jorge is anchorman for Noticiero Univision, and he joins us on the line from his office in Miami. Hello, Jorge.
Hi, I'm great to be here.
Maybe we should begin by defining our terms a bit, because I wonder if it's even accurate to say Latino community. It seems that we're talking about so many diverse groups here.
And that's the problem. I think Latinos or Hispanics define and challenge almost every definition that you want to apply. Because about 60% of all Latinos are from Mexico or Mexican Americans, another 10% from Puerto Rico, 3% from Cuba, and the rest from Central and South America. It's a very diverse group of people that challenge every definition.
And you also write, Jorge, that the Latino community is the country's largest minority bloc, that presidential candidates who don't cater to them risk losing the election. How did the Latino vote become so important?
Well, finally, the Hispanic voters and Latinos overall have reached a critical mass. A few decades ago, when there were only 1 or 2 million Hispanic voters, they didn't make a difference. But nowadays, what we have right now is what I call the Latino perfect storm. We have the country split, divided politically. At the same time, we have dozens of national organizations who are encouraging new voters to go to the polls. And then we have all these new voters, new Hispanic voters, concentrated on just a few states, among them Florida, Arizona, New Mexico, Colorado, Nevada, and Oregon. So with all these elements, again, this Hispanic perfect storm will change the political landscape of the United States.
Well, let's zero in on one of those groups. I know you're based in Miami.
Mm-hmm.
So among Cuban Americans, in the past several weeks, President Bush has restricted how often they may visit relatives in Cuba, how much money they may send there. How much does that hurt the president, or does it?
Let me first just say that overall Hispanics tend to vote more for the Democratic Party. However, the Cuban American community does exactly the opposite. I had the opportunity to talk to John Kerry just recently, and he, just as President Bush, supports the embargo. However, John Kerry believes that even within the Cuban-American community, there are some divisions. Among them, some Cuban-Americans simply do not agree with President Bush that the best idea to get rid of Fidel Castro is by limiting the amount of money that they can send to the island. John Kerry believes that opening up travel to all Americans to the island might foster these new contacts and communications between Cubans and Americans, and that this might precipitate the fall of Fidel Castro. So obviously, John Kerry does not pretend to win the Cuban-American vote. However, he is going to try to take advantage of the differences within the Cuban-American community.
Well, let's focus for a moment on some of the issues that are particularly important to Latino voters, actually to all Americans. Education is clearly one of them. And you write that 1 in 3 Latino students fail to complete high school. In California, you say that number can reach as high as 40%. Is there a solution?
There has to be a solution, and politicians and political parties and national organizations have to pay more attention to what's going on with the Latino students. It's truly a crisis. Latinos are very young, 25 years of age on average, have more children than American families, and are growing at a much faster pace. So they need jobs and good schools. And both John Kerry and President Bush have to go beyond what we call sombrero and taco politics, have to go beyond just a few words in Spanish, and they have to propose concrete solutions to a specific problem.
Well, is there an answer in bilingual education? Is this a matter of more money being needed? I mean, what specifically would address that?
It's a matter of more money. It's a matter of specifically targeting the crisis within the Hispanic community. Political candidates have to propose school for all kindergarten children. Also, we have to stress the fact that most Latinos would appreciate the support of bilingual education in the United States, despite the fact that in some states like Colorado and California, it is almost impossible to find bilingual education.
I want to also ask you about immigration reform, because, as you know, the president was both praised and vilified for his proposal earlier this year, protecting illegal immigrants who are already in the United States. You believe that proposal doesn't work. It's temporary. It's short term. But you hope the next president will expand on this issue. And I wonder what you want to hear specifically during this election campaign.
Well, what we want to hear is that something will be done about the 10 million undocumented immigrants living in this country. What are you going to do with 10 million people who are living under the shadows, who are afraid of going to work, whose children go to school without even knowing if the parents are going to be deported that day or not? Something has to be done about undocumented immigrants, and none of the candidates, unfortunately, are addressing this problem right now.
Finally, I want to ask you, Jorge, as you know, of course, many names are being floated within the Democratic Party about a running mate to John Kerry, and one person who's occasionally mentioned is Bill Richardson, governor of New Mexico, also a Latino. What are your thoughts about that?
Actually, he's complete name is Bill Richardson Lopez. Many people do not realize that his mother was from Mexico, and that actually Bill Richardson grew up in Mexico City. if the Democratic Party understands correctly that Latinos will decide this election, they will be well advised to choose a Hispanic. John Kerry understands that he needs to win almost 70% of the Hispanic vote if he wants to win the White House. One way to do it will be to choose Bill Richardson as his running mate. Is he going to do it? I don't know. But there's so much going on. The Hispanic vote is up for grabs, and Bill Richardson will definitely help John Kerry to win the White House. We'll see what the Democratic Party decides.
Thank you, Jorge.
Thank you so much. Gracias.
Jorge Ramos is a television journalist and author of the new book, The Latino Wave, How Hispanics Will Elect the Next American President.
Tomorrow on Here and Now, we check in on security in Saudi Arabia in the wake of the weekend's horrific attacks.
And our theater critic Bill Marks has a review of Edward Albee's new companion piece to The Zoo Story. That's tomorrow.
Stay with us. There's more ahead, Here and Now.
I'm Gail Harris.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
It started with a speech commemorating Brown versus Board of Education before a well-heeled, mostly black Washington crowd. But the comments made that night by comedian Bill Cosby have reverberated throughout the entire African-American community. Here's an excerpt.
Brown versus the Board of Education is no longer the white person's problem. We've got to take the neighborhood back. We've got to go in there. It's right around the corner. It's standing on the corner. It can't speak English. It doesn't want to speak English. I can't even talk the way these people talk. Why you ain't where you is, go wild back. I don't know who these people are. And I blamed the kid until I heard the mother talk. And then I heard the father talk. This is all in the house. Everybody knows it's important to speak English, except these knuckleheads. You can't land a plane with why you ain't where. You can't be a doctor with that kind of crap coming out of your mouth.
Well, Clarence Page is a syndicated columnist based in Washington for the Chicago Tribune. Clarence, some people, including hip-hop mogul Russell Simmons, say Cosby unfairly attacked poor blacks who still suffer discrimination.
Well, if he had used more genteel language, we wouldn't be talking about Cosby right now. But, you know, when you get down to it, you talk to Bill Cosby, you talk to me, you talk to any African-American that has made any kind of a success of themselves, and they're going to point back to somebody in their lives who took them by the hand and guided them along these basic old-fashioned values. And I'm talking about my friends who are Black Panthers, and there's nothing that extraordinary about it. I think what's really interesting is how people on some level, this resonates, and I think maybe we've reached a new level of dialogue in the African-American community. I hope so.
What do you? I was going to say, is that a good thing or a bad thing? You write that Bill Cosby violated what you call BPC, Black Political Correctiveness.
That's right. I think that's great. We need to get past that stricture that we impose upon ourselves of saying, hey, you don't want to wash our dirty laundry out in public, as if the white man is so dumb he doesn't know when our laundry is dirty. You know, all that's strictly a self-destructive attitude. I'm finding more and more African Americans are saying, you know, let's not worry so much about what white people think of us, and let's talk about what we think of us.
Well, but what about, as you know, there have been a lot of critics, as you said, a lot of dialogue about this. Mr. Cosby's comments about prisoners, for instance, saying these people are not political prisoners, people getting shot in the head over a piece of pound cake. We're saying the cops shouldn't have shot him. What the hell was he doing with the pound cake in his hand? Jimmy Israel, who's in Ohio, he's a columnist for Africana.
Right.
He says comments like that are irresponsible, and it gives license to anyone to shoot our kids in the street for petty crime.
I respect Jimmy, and I think he's wrong. But, you know, we have killed more of our own people per year. Our black youths are killing each other per year at a higher rate than the Ku Klux Klan did in a whole century. And that's what disturbs me and a lot of other black folks, too. But that's not very sexy for the mainstream media when we're talking in the black community about that. Hey, what are we going to do about our kids killing each other? What are we going to do about so many of our young black males going to jail?
Well, you know,
and
you
now
just
a rising number of young black females. That's what Cosby's talking about.
But you use the words our kids. He used the words these people referring to parents, referring to kids, referring to prison inmates.
But, you know, when we talk about these people, quote unquote, Ross Perot got in trouble for that kind of language in NAACP. But, you know, Chris Rock, who I respect and admire a great deal as kind of a Richard Pryor for this era, you know, he has a whole bit where he talks about, I love black people, but I hate niggas. And we're talking to a crowd that's 90% black, but black folks just jump up and applaud that statement because we know what he's saying. You know, I heard a man who was in his 60s was given millions upon millions of dollars to help black education, and he still sees this 50% dropout rate in New York City and some other cities, Chicago and others. This horrendous drop. In 2004, I hear a man who is very frustrated.
Well, you write in your column that conservative talk radio and TV hosts such as Bill O'Reilly, Sean Hannity, are using Cosby's remarks to sort of jab at liberals who find things politically incorrect about them.
They're really using Cosby's remarks to boost their ratings, let's face it.
And do you worry about
believe
that?
Believe me. No, that's just a game, and I think people are becoming sophisticated enough to see through it.
Clarence Page, thanks so much.
My pleasure.
Clarence Page, syndicated columnist with the Chicago Tribune. Well, we now turn to Dr. Angela Page Cook, director and co-founder of Page Academy, a private school in Roxbury, Massachusetts. And, Doctor, your school is predominantly African-American. What were your thoughts when you first heard Bill Cosby's comments?
Well, I thought he was right on key. I think that some of the words that he used were a little inflammatory in terms of how people would perceive what he was saying. But the content of what he's saying, I think, is certainly what's going on. What I've observed, parents in our school are the working poor primarily, and so they don't have a lot of time to spend with their children. So they'll give them $300 Nikes because, you know, that's something that is tangible that they can give their child. Or they'll give them diamond earrings because that's something that they can have and hold and say, oh, I have a diamond stud in my ear or in my nose or wherever they choose to put it. There needs to be a paradigm shift in terms of how parents look at what they're doing for their children, that they need to realize that spending quality time with them is what's important, not giving them material gifts.
But Bill Cosby also talked about the way parents speak, blaming them for the way their children speak. Is it also just a matter of telling parents to speak correctly?
Well, I think that they need to know the difference between English and Ebonics so that you can switch. I'm speaking standard English to you today because that's what the listeners need to resonate with. But if I were in another setting where it was proper for me to speak Ebonics in black dialect, then I would be able to do that as well.
He seemed critical of that.
Well, I think that that's a mistake. I mean, I think that you have to understand that languages are a way of expression and that Ebonics as a way of expression is a language, and that's a way of expression. But I think that the confusion is when you don't say there's an appropriate time and place to use that.
What do you say to the criticism of his comments that they might be taken by others to criticize blacks, you know, given a pass to do it, instead of admitting that discrimination does still exist and does still have an impact on lower-income families?
Well, there's no way that that can be a valid assessment of what he says, because racism does still have an impact on blacks in this country. We still don't earn the same amount of money as whites in this country.
You mean the two things can mutually coexist? You can still say there's discrimination, but say that blacks have a responsibility to take care of their own language, how they treat their kids, et cetera.
That's the reality. If you don't have not only a high school diploma, but if you don't have a college degree, you're not going to succeed. And even if you have one, you're going to be discriminated against. So you have to work hard to make sure that your children are getting those things, or else there's no hope.
Angela Page Cook, thanks so much.
You're welcome. It was a pleasure.
Angela is the director of the Page Academy in Roxbury, Massachusetts.
Still to come, a ballet classic undergoes an extreme makeover. We talked to choreographer Christopher Weldon about his staging of Swan Lake.
You're listening to Here and Now.
The tiny island nation of Nauru in the South Pacific is about to go bankrupt. In 1968, every man, woman, and child on the island was worth $2.4 million. But by 1998, the Republic of Nauru was in serious financial trouble. To raise money, Nauru remortgaged some Australian real estate. The mortgage holder? General Electric. Well, now the loan is due, and Nauru can't pay up. So GE is selling Nauru's Australian properties worth an estimated $200 million, and with them, the country's best chance for economic recovery. Helen Bogdan is the Nauru government spokeswoman in Melbourne, Australia. Hello, Helen.
Hello, Gail.
Well, Helen, tell us what the story is here. It's being described as a riches-to-rags story. What happened?
Well, I think there are many reasons why there has been a downturn for Nauru. Bad investments. There's been a growth in population, and of course that alters the equation. But also there's been the exhaustion of the phosphate reserves, which were the main economic benefits for the government of Nauru and why Nauru was so wealthy. But there's also the downturn in the rural economy in Australia, which was Nauru's largest market.
Helen, some critics of the Nauru government say that the country has blown through $2 billion through what one opposition lawmaker on Nauru says was a combination of mismanagement, foolish investment, ignorance, and corruption. Do you think that's a fair assessment, and is there any way to fix the situation?
Well, I think it's fairly fair, but it's not very, very kind or understanding to some of the difficulties that the Nauruans themselves faced to maintain an economy in the centre of the Pacific with people whose expectations were very high after having been so wealthy is not quite as easy as it may seem. Everything has to be imported. That means food, power, and at times water. So living on the island has not been very easy for the number of people who are now there, which is 10,000 people.
Are you at all optimistic about Nauru's future at this point?
Yes, I am, because I don't think that the major power in the region, which is Australia, would let Nauru sink into oblivion. Australia has been the major beneficiary of the phosphate, which has been sold, and up until 1968 was sold at a price which was more comfortable for Australia than it was for Nauru. Nauru has made money, there's no doubt about it, since 1968 when they gained independence. But unfortunately, some of the investments, such as the shipping line and some of the properties, have not been a great success.
How do people on Nauru feel about General Electric?
I think it was a fairly tough arrangement that GE had with Nauru. 20% on the amount that was borrowed is a very substantial amount of money, particularly if none of the property was to be for sale. GE is acting in its own best interests, but unfortunately it's to the detriment of a very small and vulnerable nation.
Helen, thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Helen Bogdan is a spokeswoman for the government of Nauru. She spoke to us from Melbourne, Australia.
Stay with us. There's more ahead, here and now.
I'm Gail Harris.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
Why mess with a classic? A rising star in the ballet world is. Choreographer Christopher Wheeldon is reworking most of Swan Lake for Pennsylvania Ballet's 40th anniversary season. In traditional productions of Swan Lake, Prince Siegfried tragically falls in love with Princess Odette, who's been turned into a swan by the evil sorcerer Von Rothbart. But the ballet has changed some since its 1877 premiere. There's even been a Swan Lake with bare-chested male swans and a gay prince. So what's a choreographer to do? Christopher Wheeldon joins us on the line from Philadelphia. Christopher, what changes will you be making?
I've taken elements from the original scenario and reset them, in a sense, in a slightly different setting. It was the character of Rothbart that sort of led me to my concept, because I really didn't want a big sort of fuzzy, furry-looking creature with horns running around the stage in the second act. That's always bothered me. Whenever I see a Swan Lake, I'm always slightly uncomfortable about the Rothbart character. So I wanted to make his character more present throughout the rest of the production.
And what is he now?
That character actually kind of led me to the famous paintings by Edgar Degas in Paris of the Paris Opera ballet dancers. And I noticed in these paintings there are often mysterious sort of backstage patron figures, top-hatted patron figures. Sometimes they're just shadows. Sometimes they're a little bit more present amongst a group of dancers. And that gave me the idea on how I was going to flesh out this character of Rothbart and tie it in also with a world that that often an audience doesn't get the chance to see, which is the backstage rehearsal world of a ballet company.
How are you going to do that?
Just in a nutshell, the ballet begins in a rehearsal studio and is, rather than setting the scene in a medieval courtyard of a medieval castle, of a Gothic castle, these are dancers portraying the roles of Siegfried and the queen and the court.
Has that ever been done before with Swan Lake?
I don't know.
I think
days you're pretty lucky if you hit on a concept that hasn't been done in some way, but I don't know of one that's been done that way. And as the production develops, these dancers become their characters in Swan Lake. So in a sense, it sort of develops into the story.
Can you explain the endurance of this piece? Why is that?
I think it's really, more than anything else, beyond the technical demands of the roles, it's just the story. It's the ultimate fairy tale. You know, it's about love and betrayal and magic and the good things about life. You know, the bond between two people when they're in love, and how even, you know, when it turns tragic, it can remain a strong bond. And it remains always a very beautiful piece as well, and a very transporting piece of work, partly because of the music. It's romantic and panoramic and grand, and it really conjures up the fairy tale.
The ending is always a big question. Do you have a surprise for us there?
Well, a lot of productions approach the end that the spell cannot be broken because Siegfried has betrayed his true love for Odette, so she's doomed, in a sense, to be a swan forever, and she rather overdramatically hurls herself into the lake, which is can be very funny, actually, you know, picturing the mattress that's catching her over the other side of the little cluster of boulders. So I'm not doing that, but...
So you will have a surprise ending.
Certainly it's a little different.
Maybe they'll kill Rothbart, finally.
Who knows?
Christopher, thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Christopher Wheeldon is resident choreographer of the New York City Ballet. Pennsylvania Ballet's production of His Swan Lake premieres in Philadelphia this weekend.
A ballerina gets sawed in half in an entirely different type of production that the company Snappy Dance Theater stages in Boston this weekend, in a piece inspired by the renowned American artist, the late Edward Gorey. Gorey is perhaps most famous for the spooky credits seen on the PBS program Mystery. His darkly humorous ink drawings of bizarre creatures and Edwardian figures meeting untimely ends have long fascinated people, And they've inspired Snappy Dance Theater's artistic director, Martha Mason. Here and Now's Lynn Minigon spoke with her about the unusually titled piece that Mason is choreographing.
The title is a very gory-sounding title, but it's not a gory original name. And I called it The Temperamental Wobble. We talked about it as a group, and it seems to be that the wobble can be something that is similar to the butterfly effect, and something that seems very unimportant ends up affecting someone else in a very unique and extreme way that you would never know about. Gori's work is very absurd, very dark, and very ironic, and he takes his illustrations from real life and then makes it more extreme, and that's something that Snappy's been very interested in. It's been very enriching in a way to have to try and not necessarily inhabit Gori's mind. We're trying to recreate a world of Gori-esque characters.
Can you guys try that again with your toes just barely off the ground?
We have a wonderful ballet duet. I hate to say a parody of ballet, but it has a very absurd ending that ends up with the dancer's legs being sawn off. And it goes dark, and you hear the sound of a saw, but the dancer doesn't know what's happening. And then all of a sudden, a pair of legs appear from upside down and walk away from her, and she chases them off. Gori's drawings were extremely physically dramatic illustrations, and so it's felt very easy to imagine how his characters would move. And often we started with just copying a pose, and then we would improvise. There's a story about three orphans, so we decided that we would create something that's not about the orphans, but now we're three ambiguous cousins. Les cousins ambigu. And the ambiguous cousins have an umbrella, and I walk on their shoulders in the light, but we're always looking for happiness and not finding it. And in a gory way, just as I have found happiness, I fall off their shoulders. And when the lights come up again, they're looking down at me and I'm dead, and they just go, oh well, and they go on and wander away looking for happiness. And that's a very gory thing, that it's so dark and so absurd that it becomes funny and people giggle and they don't know if they should be or not. But I think that was intentional, and that's the way we want this performance to be perceived as well.
How did you find the music?
In 1996, I discovered a composer from Berlin, Michael Rodak, and it's been so fun working with him long distance. I had a melody in my head. Last March, I had a dream that with this melody in it in four-part harmony, and I actually sang that to Michael over the phone, and it became a theme for the entire piece.
How does it go?
There are those things that happen in a fairly mundane way that turn the quotidian into a truly different day. The wobble can be friend, but then it also can be foe. And when it happens, someone somewhere shall be filled with woe. Oh, 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 oh.
Snappy Dance Theater's The Temperamental Wobble premieres in Boston this weekend. For more information, check out our website, here-now.org.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston.
Our production team includes Andrea Shea, Lynn Menegon, April Peavy, Alan Cockle, Karen Miller-Medson, Lindsay Crudell, Emiko Tamagawa, and Stefano Katsonis. Our managing editor is Kathleen McKenna.
Vince Fairchild is our engineer. He's assisted by Thomas Terry. Our web producer is Zach Christo, and our intern is Nick Weiss-Richmond.
The senior producer of Here and Now is Mark Navin.
Is there a fly in here? I'm Robin Young.
I'm Gail Harris.
Get into your radio.
And join us again, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.